We've looked at the book of 1 John, the epistle of 1 John over the last several Sunday nights. Slowly made our way, spent a couple of times in each of the chapters there. Made it through 1 John finally last time. And so we're ready tonight to turn the page and to look at 2 John. And what this short little letter, just 13 little verses, just take you about a minute to read through this whole thing. It's one of only five books in all the Bible that's just the one chapter. You notice when Brother John read this for us tonight, he didn't say 2 John chapter whatever. He just said 2 John verses 6 through 11, because that's all there is. There's just the one chapter. But one of the things that is intriguing about this to me, I'm of the inclination, I'm one of those kinds of people that I am fascinated by personal correspondence from famous older sources. That may sound weird, because in some ways, in modern terms, I don't want anybody's correspondence. I don't want to read Facebook. I don't want to see those things. You know, if you've got this vacation, you went to that beach, you know, great. I don't want to read about it, right? I don't do Facebook. But now if it's ancient correspondence, like some famous writer who spent all their time trying to craft these thoughts, and all this time trying to craft these sentences because they were trying to influence people. But then over here they got diaries. Over here they got letters, personal letters that they wrote to people that they thought were just going to go to one person or one family. Not these things over here they thought were going to be consumed by tons of people, but these private letters, this private correspondence. I'm fascinated by that. That was intended for the few, but now we get the insight to be able to see it. Not long ago, just this past week, was reading some short biographies on several different writers, like Tolstoy and some others, and the diaries that these people kept will blow your mind. The things that they would say about people they knew, the things they would say about their own families. Really deplorable, but kind of amazing. And so whenever we turn here to 2 John, the reason I bring all that up is because when you see something like here in 2 John, we're getting inside information here. This is one of those very personal letters. Now there's debate, and we could spend a lot of time, I guess, debating, you know, who wrote it, who is he writing to, what's this mean about the elect lady, and all of this. But just read these first few lines with me. The elder, this is identifying the writer here, the elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth. And not only I, but all who love and know the truth, because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son in truth and love. I rejoice greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth just as we are commanded by the Father. And now I ask you, dear lady, not as though I were writing to you a new commandment, but the one we've had from the beginning, that we love one another. Now I'll pause right there because Brother John started reading for us in verse 6. And so we've already heard that. But I want you to drop down with me to verse 12, the way that he begins to wrap this up and conclude this letter. Though I have much to write to you, I'd rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk to you face to face so that our joy may be complete. The children of your elect sister greet you. Okay, now here's the deal. I think the simple answer is this, and this is the thought we're going to go with tonight to present these few brief thoughts here. The elder is the Apostle John, the same guy who wrote the book of Revelation, the same guy who wrote the Gospel of John. The elder is John the Apostle, and he's writing to a specific woman. I don't think he's writing to a congregation. He may be writing to a woman who has people meeting in her home, some of that effect. But when he says the elect lady, I don't think he means it's not some code word for the church. I think he's saying to you, special woman who I know. It reminds me of, speaking of older writers, reminds me of some correspondence that's been put together by C.S. Lewis, where over a course of several years, he wrote to this specific woman, Here he is over in England, she's in the United States, and they've corresponded back and forth over and over again for years. And when this material was collected and put into a book, she asked that her name not be included. And so it's just called Letters to an American Lady. So here's this collection of wisdom from C.S. Lewis, just Letters to an American Lady. And when I see this, the elder to the elect lady and her children, I don't see anything strange about seeing this in that same kind of vein, because it's not unusual for John to write personal letters. If you think you got a question about that, just the way I look at it in my Bible, just look over to the other page. The elder to the beloved Gaius, he's writing a personal letter here. And that's not unusual for New Testament writers to do, right? The letter of Timothy, Paul writes to Timothy in 1 and 2 Timothy. Titus, Paul writes to Titus. Philemon, Paul writes to Philemon. A letter to these people. Okay, that's enough about that. I think you'll get my gist now. You understand the drift of where I'm coming from. This is John the Apostle writing to this special woman with these instructions for the people that she'll be with, because he knows she'll share this message with them. In keeping with the theme, note how John doesn't even name himself, just calls himself the elder. And I think here this means, and I don't mean this in any kind of disrespectful way, I think he just means the older guy, the old guy, the mature guy, the one who's been with Jesus Christ and now has walked and walked and lived and seen and done. I am mature, and I'm writing to those who are younger, those who I see as my children in the faith, those who I see as those that I cannot wait but to see the way you grow up and mature and grow and flourish. He's old. And he's writing from the prospect or the position of someone who's a mentor and helper to those that he's trying to help mature in the faith. So here's the setting. Here's what this letter is about. In a nutshell, it's about encouragement. Someone who is grounded, someone who is faithful, someone who is powerful in the faith and the truth is writing to someone who needs encouragement. And part of what he's writing about, part of the way that he's going to encourage not just this woman, but those that she's associated with, part of the way he's going to encourage the church is he's going to tell them this: you've got to be evangelistic. You've got to be the kind of people who will spread the truth. But part of evangelism, now note this, part of evangelism has to do, we're kind of mixed up and they think all evangelism is just sending information out. Well, what if you're sending out lies? What if you're sending out something wrong? Maybe it's a piece of paper, it's a tract, it's a book, and you pay for hundreds of these to be sent somewhere. What if they're lies? Have you engaged in evangelism? What if you send someone, some man, some team? What if you send some people out and they don't know what they're talking about? Well, we sent them to Africa. Well, they don't know Matthew from Malachi. What have we done? Have we engaged in evangelism? So he says here, I'm desperate for you to engage in evangelism, but part of what that is to be careful. There's going to be people, traveling missionaries, or they're going to be coming through town. They'll be looking for places to stay. They'll be hopeful to find hospitality. You cannot help those who will not teach the truth. Part of evangelism is making sure that the truth is what's shared. The truth is what's spread. Not just some message that feels religious. Not just some message about, quote unquote, about Jesus. But the truth from Jesus. And so he's going to say here, I'm encouraging you to keep walking, to keep doing what's right. But when it comes to evangelism, you better teach only the truth. So I'd like for us to take a brief look at just four little things here, four little bullet points, if you will, that I think are some pertinent lessons, pertinent applications that we can make from this amazing and powerful but short little letter here. From the elder to the elect lady, from John to this woman. The first one is this, has to do with the truth. We've got all four of them here, the four things we want to deal with, because we'll do them quickly. The truth, a major theme of this short letter, and really a major theme that John deals with all the time. Remember when we went through the epistle of 1 John and how often he talked about using your mind? and distinguishing between false prophets and the truth. Even going back to the Gospel of John, John chapter 8, verses 31 and 32, if you abide in my word, you're my disciples indeed, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Even in the book of Revelation, he talks about Jesus Christ, the faithful and the true one. John is concerned about the truth. John is concerned about the fact that the right thing be taught. Just read with me here in those first four verses again, and I want you to be listening. Five times you're going to hear the word truth just in these first few verses. Look at this. The elder, the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth. And not only I, but also all who know the truth. Because of the truth that abides in us and will abide with us forever. Grace, mercy, peace be with us from God the Father and Jesus Christ, Father, Son, in truth and love. And then one more. The other one is, the fourth one is the fourth verse. I rejoice greatly to find some of your children walking in truth. So quite clearly, John has got something on his mind. Within the first few lines, he has hammered home this concept of you better be concerned with the truth. I'm concerned with the truth, he says. You better be as well. Truth is connected to everything. Truth is connected to love. Truth is connected to the happiness, the way that we have a fulfilled life. Truth matters in all aspects. It permeates every single aspect of life. Love and truth. All who know the truth. Truth abides. Now notice that in the second verse there. Truth that abides in us will be with us forever. People and fads and ideas and traditions and all these different things, they're going to come in and out, and they're going to come and they're going to go, and they're going to crumble by the wayside. But the truth will remain. As Jesus Christ himself said about himself, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. That's never going to change. Until the Lord himself returns, that concept, that idea is going to remain the same. And so he says here, abides forever. It doesn't change. Isn't that amazing to think about all the different things that have been, all the different philosophies, all the different ideas that have been proposed and held up for a few moments in time as the answer? And then they crumble because we realize, well, that didn't work. And then the next one comes along. Well, that didn't work. That guy didn't know what he was talking about either. But the truth of Jesus Christ abides and remains. Every challenger comes, seeks to take it down, seeks to change it, and it remains. Now, in this first concept of the truth here, you've got to note with me also verses 9 and 10. Because he comes back to it. Even though he uses that word, truth, 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 over and over again at the first. At the end, he's not using that same word, but he's still dealing with the same concept. In verse 9, when he says, everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ, might as well have just said, and does not abide in the truth. Remember, because what John himself said in John 8, 31, if you abide in me, abide in my word, stick with me and know the truth, it'll set you free. Everyone who goes on ahead and doesn't abide in the teaching of Christ doesn't have God. Whoever abides in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, if anyone comes to you with a different version of the truth, if someone comes to you with a different slant, a different idea other than the truth, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting. For whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. What does it mean in verse 9 to go on ahead? How do you go ahead of the teaching of Christ? Well, I think there's maybe a lot of ways that we could split that, a lot of ways to define that. But here's the simplest way to understand it. The message of Christ, the authorization of Christ goes to here. And if I choose to go here, I've gone beyond what the Lord allows me to do. I've gone beyond what the Lord has authorized, what the Lord has commanded, what the Lord has sought to be the will for me in my life. I've gone beyond it. He says, here's what I want you to do. Here's the way I want you to live. Here's the way I want you to worship. Here's what I want. You go beyond that, you've gone beyond who I am. You've gone beyond where I am. And where my light covers, where my grace covers, you've gone beyond that. Not abiding in the teaching of Christ. If I can't find authorization, if I can't find, as has been said for so many centuries, of thus saith the Lord, I've got a problem. And then in verse 10, he says, If anyone comes to you and doesn't bring this teaching, if they've got some other teaching, they shouldn't be received. When I read this, it reminds me of what Paul wrote. Flip back to Galatians chapter 1. Galatians chapter 1. And Paul will voice his shock, his astonishment, that some of these Christians in Galatia could have even begun to entertain the idea of going away from the truth that was revealed. Galatians chapter 1, beginning at verse 6. I'm astonished that you're so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning, now note this, to a different gospel. You could just as easily read that without doing any damage, you know, to the teachings of the text, to read that this way. You've gone beyond the teachings of Christ. You've turned into a different gospel. He says, now, we all realize, not that there is another, but there are some who trouble you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. There are some who want to go beyond the teaching of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we've preached, if any of us should ever come to you and preach a doctrine that goes beyond the doctrine of Christ, let him be accursed. As we've said before, so now I say again, if anyone's preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one that you received, let him be accursed. And so then he says, you'd better make sure you know the truth. You'd better make sure that you live the truth. You better make sure you share the truth. And you better make sure you're not letting anyone distort the truth. And then he goes on to say, that's not enough. It's not just enough that you don't distort it yourself. He says, don't receive this into your house. Verse 11, for whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. Ephesians 5:11 would say it this way, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. If you've ever wondered why, maybe sometimes to varying degrees, why it seems like we take such extreme measures to make it clear where we stand, why do we go to such lengths to make it clear in what we teach? Why? Why is it such a big deal? Well, here's part of the clear answer right here. Doctrine is not the same thing. Let me say this plainly, as clearly as I am able. Doctrine is not the same thing as tradition. Doctrine is not the same thing as my preference. Doctrine is what we understand to be revealed directly from the mind, directly from the heart of Almighty God. And it works this way. What the Almighty asks of us, or maybe said this way, what the Almighty authorizes us to do, we respond with compliance. Now, part of this means we're going to give an effort to know and to understand, because you know what the implication here in 2 John is when he's writing to this lady and those that are with her? He's at least under the assumption they know enough about the truth to defend it. It seems like we may be in a place in a lot of areas in our modern world where many of us don't even know enough to refute that which is false. Competing theories, competing doctrines, competing ideas are presented, and we're just stuck. What do I do? You got to be able to know enough to be able to refute that which is false. The truth matters. And I spent about 10 more minutes on that than what I meant to. These next 3 points will be fast, I promise. Look at this second one here, the cause for rejoicing. This deals with verse 4. So you note verse 4. Be looking at that. Let me ask you this question while you're reading verse 4 to yourself. What sets you off in celebration? I don't mean just kind of what makes you kind of feel nice. You know what I mean? Because there's sometimes you can do something, see something, say something, and it just kind of makes you feel nice inside. But there's other things that literally make your body move, and you like go, yeah. What is it that sets you off in celebration? Personally, I'm not pointing fingers anywhere else, I'm just saying, personally, I know I scream at football games. There's been a basketball game or 10 or 1,000 that I've screamed at. I know some of you may do as that as well. You can tell from this short little letter here John's different from most of us. He rejoices when he hears about faithfulness. I rejoiced. Now, let this sink in. I rejoiced greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth. When I read that, that humbles me. It makes me realize how much further I have to go in my quest to love and to live like Jesus. I mean, I got a long ways to go just to be like John, let alone be like Jesus. Now, don't get me wrong. It's not saying anything in here that we're not allowed to have other interests. It just states plainly, and it puts the emphasis where it should be, the emphasis on eternity. We have to resolve to be more excited about what matters, more excited about people, more excited about the truth, more excited about evangelism. That's what John's getting at anyway. And so I need to ask myself, how would I finish this sentence? I rejoice greatly to find... How do I finish that? I rejoice greatly when I find... He says, I rejoice greatly, I celebrate, I go crazy when I hear about people that are walking in the truth. The gospel being shared. Telling people what Jesus has done. Telling about Him coming to this earth, living, dying, being raised, ascending, interceding. Telling people about what Jesus has done. That ought to excite us. Having the gospel defended should excite us. Having hearts being encouraged should excite us. Having hearts being blended together, not just in times of prayer, not just in times of song, but hearts blended together because they know they're brothers and sisters. They know they've got a common goal. They know they've got a common Savior. Things such as these and so many others should cause us to rejoice. What causes you to rejoice? Third on the list there is this idea of losing and winning. If you look in verse 8, he makes this very interesting observation. He says, now look, watch yourselves. Be awake. Listen. Watch yourselves so that you may not lose what we work for. And just in case you're curious as to what he means, well, maybe he just means their numbers, right? They've built up to about 60 folks there at that house church. Maybe he just means let's not lose those folks we've got. That's not what he means. Because he goes on and he defines it. He says, be careful you don't lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. He's talking about the possibility, the very real possibility of losing that which we've been blessed with. Again, it reminds me of the book of Galatians. Real quick, go to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians 5. And here Paul writes a number of things. Galatians 5:1. For freedom Christ has set us free, so in bondage and then set free, and says, so stand firm therefore and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. Been set free, don't go back into the cage. Verse 4. You've been severed from Christ. You who would be justified by the law, you've fallen from grace. In grace, standing clear, as Paul would say it in Romans chapter 5, I stand in the grace of God. And then he says here, now you've moved out of that and you've fallen from grace. Then verse 7, you were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? You were on the track. You were headed towards the goal line, the finish line, the tape. And then you veered off, started running through the woods. Why in the world did you change course? You see, he's making it plain. As much as we may hate to say it, he's making it plain. There's a possibility of losing your reward. So he says, watch, examine yourself. Be sure, as he wrote in 1 John chapter 1, verse 7, be sure you continue to walk in the light because a possible loss is a reality. But amazing reward is also real. We won't take the time to read it tonight, but I want you to write this down. Revelation 2, verse 7, verse 11, verse 17, and verse 26, Revelation 3, 5, 12, and 21. If you didn't get all those down, don't worry. It's just one time to each one of the seven churches in Asia. To all seven of those churches, Jesus Christ says, to those who overcome, I give this reward. It changes each time for all seven. But for all seven of them, he makes this beautiful statement. I've got a crown for you. I've got a white robe for you. I've got a throne for you. I've got a special stone with just your name on it. I've got a key for you. He was painting these images. There are beautiful, wonderful, amazing rewards set aside for those who don't lose. Be aware. He says it this way. Be awake, be watchful, be ready. I'm warning you. Don't lose what you've gained. Let's keep pressing towards the prize. And then the final thing that I want to mention here comes from verse 12, this idea of face-to-face. Verse 12, he says, you know, I've got so much more I want to say. I could write a book, he says, so much more I want to write to you. But note this, here's why he stops. It's not because, well, I've got to stop because I've got a dinner appointment. I've got to stop because I've got a doctor. No, I'm going to stop because the rest of the things I want to say, I'd rather not use paper and ink. I want to say face-to-face. And then he says it this way, I want to say it face to face. I want to share this with you heart to heart so that our joy may be complete. We live in a time when many would rather communicate via screens than personal interaction. There's, you know, sometimes jokes are made, but often it's not even a joke. You can see it. You see the family sitting there. Maybe there's four at the table, and they're sitting only inches from each other. But all four are heads down on their screens, the bright lights of the screen in their eyes. I'm inches away. Deal with me. But we're here on the screen. We live in a time when many would rather communicate with screens rather than personal communication. I recently read a book by one of my favorite contemporary philosophers. And his wife, as he writes this book, it's sort of a memoir, and as he writes this book, his wife is dealing with the exact same kind of dementia that my mother battled. So this is one of those things, I kind of saw it as a challenge. I'm going to hate reading this book, but I'm going to make myself do it. And this philosopher makes the point. He says, look, I utilize Facebook. He said, look, I'm a man of the 21st century. I utilize all of the common conveniences, and I'm thankful for them, and I'm happy about them, he says. But in this one chapter, he pleads with people to keep the ability to communicate face to face. He says, look, some words simply cannot be as effectively communicated if they're not done face to face. So here I am reading from this philosopher. I'm not expecting him to mention anything about 2 John. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, he says, why do you think John says, I could write more, but I'm stopping so I can see you face to face? He was like, look, text somebody, that's great. Call somebody, that's great. Email somebody, that's great. Post on somebody's wall, that's great. But don't you dare let that be the substitute for you sitting there with someone, hearts being poured out to each other. Because there's sometimes, like Job's friends, when they didn't say a word for a week, but they sat there shoulder to shoulder with him on the trash heap, in the ashes, in his pain, and they really, really helped. Being there face to face was the only way to do it. John was about 2,000 years before the use of smartphones. But something he shows us here is that humans haven't changed. He just had to say some things in the actual presence of these people. Some joy can really only be complete if we're together. So let's be challenged by these words. Let's seek ways to be together. Let's ensure that we're going to be together for eternity. This is what John said. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son in truth and love. Let me ask you this. Are there some letters that you need to write? Even more, are there some people you need to see face to face? Are there things you need to say? Maybe it's tonight you need to come, as it were, face to face with your Lord Himself and say some things to Him to make things right. Our joy can only be complete when we see Him face to face. And so I ask you, are you ready? If not, come face to face with the one who can help while we stand and sing.